answered. All right, so section E. What are our objectives today? We're going to talk about what is the intent of section E. We're going to define what a hallucination and a delusion is in relative to the MDS-3O. We're going to describe potential problems and behaviors and impact of those behaviors upon others. And we're going to conduct an assessment for behavioral symptoms. And ultimately, which is a goal for all the sections, we're going to code it correctly. So the items in this section identify behavior symptoms in the last 7 days, so it's a 7-day look back period. And these symptoms that we're looking at may cause distress to residents or are distressing or disruptive to the facility and the staff and members or care environment. So keep that in mind as we go through this, because often we're looking at two components here. What effect does the behavior have on the resident? And then what effect does the behavior have on the environment in which everyone is living in the nursing home? Such behaviors may place residents at risk for certainly injury, isolation, or inactivity. So if they're, let's say, constantly calling out, they may be yelled at by other residents, they may be kind of pushed off to the side or isolated, and it can cause them to maybe not be involved in as many activities. So behaviors may also indicate an unrecognized need. And I think later on today I'm going to be talking on section J, and we're going to be talking about pain. So let's not forget, and I think this is one thing to remember, not only with 2O but with 3O, these sections are not done in isolation. They all may have interrelations to each other. So when someone may have a behavior, it's our job sometimes to be the detective and figure out what's going on with the resident. So is there an unrecognized need for that resident? Is whatever behavior that they're presenting maybe an indicator that the resident is having some pain or discomfort, for example. It also may indicate that they have a particular preference, like they don't want to do something that we would like them to do. Or it may be an indicator, or first indicator, as we talked about yesterday a little bit, about an illness that may be starting to brew within the resident. It includes behaviors that are potentially harmful to the resident himself or others, and the emphasis is to identify the behavior, not the intent. And the identifying a behavior does not necessarily imply a medical diagnosis. That's not what we're trying to do here. We're trying to say what is going on, what may be the potential trigger or cause or unrecognized need, and what can we do to either adjust the environment, our approach, or meet that need for that resident. So we also will be looking at identification of the frequency and the impact of the symptoms, and this is a critical point for the MDS-3O. So what is the impact? It must distinguish behaviors that constitute problems for those that are not problematic. And once the frequency and impact of the behavior symptoms are accurately determined, follow-up evaluation and care plan interventions can be developed to either, like we talked about earlier, improve the symptoms or reduce the impact of whatever behavior they have upon the general environment in the nursing home. So when we look at Section E, we want to focus on the resident's actions. Do not focus on the intent of the behavior. And often, you'll see some examples as we go through the program today. People kind of excuse away a behavior, so they kind of ignore the behavior, saying, well, they didn't really mean to do that. Well, that's okay. They may not have meant to do it. But what we're looking for in this particular section of the MDS is what is the behavior, what is the action. So we really are going to take the intent piece of it for this component out of it. And then staff may have become used to the behavior and may underreport problematic behaviors or minimize behavior by presuming intent. So I think this is a very classic thing, and we certainly saw this even with using the MDS-2O when we went out in our DAVE project, and I certainly have seen it in my own personal life when I've been out in facilities and working with them. For example, this one jumps to mind all the time to me. I was working in a facility, doing some consulting in a facility, that had a 60-bed unit that ended up a dementia unit, and it was never intended to be a dementia unit. It's just they kind of, and I really want to almost say dumped, residents onto this unit. So it was this very long hallway. Well, it was quite an adventure to go on this particular unit. And any given day on the unit, they had the exhibitionist, this one man who liked to run around in the buff. They had lots of people who were calling out. They had lots of invasive wanderers. They had people who were exit seeking, on and on and on. It certainly was not your premier model of care of the cognitively impaired. So as I was spending some time on the unit and I was going in and looking at some of the charts and talking to the staff, one of the things that I noticed is that nowhere really in their medical records did they ever document any of these behaviors. And they had a variety of ways to do it. They had behavior monitoring sheets, right? A lot of people have those, kind of like a flow sheet, sometimes kept in the medication administration record. I went through a variety of charts. I did all kinds of things. I couldn't find any of these behaviors. So I pulled the staff together, and I said, you know what? I want to talk to you. And they were like, okay. I said, listen, you guys have a really incredible unit here. And so they're kind of sitting there. And I said, it's amazing. So now the staff's kind of sitting up nice and straight, very proud. I said, it's probably unique in the whole of the United States. And they're like, wow, okay. I said, you have a 60-bed dementia unit, and you have angels for residents. There's not one behavior, there's not one issue or concern related to people acting out or inappropriate behaviors. And the staff's looking at me like I've been drinking. And I said to them, and they're like, well, what are you crazy, Anne? And I said, well, no, because I just spent all this time going through your records and looking at everything. And, you know, Mr. Smith down the hall, who likes to take his clothes off on a regular basis and go up and down the hallway, and, you know, Mrs. Jones, and I kind of named off a few people. I said, according to your medical records, if we did a retrospective review, if we just took all your records and didn't go on your unit, you had a perfect unit. And they're like, but that's who they are, Ann. This is that, like, they've become used to the behavior, so they didn't document it. And we saw the same thing on a regular basis when we were out in the Dave 2 project. We'd be on the units, these people called out constantly. You talk to staff, and they said, well, that's who they are. They always do that behavior. And so the staff were just used to it, but they weren't monitoring that behavior. Now, what does that lead to if you don't monitor the behavior? What do you think? I'm sorry? Well, it could be worsening behavior. Maybe we're not digging down to figure out what the cause of the behavior is, right? But it becomes just, you know, it becomes just commonplace. It becomes an accepted behavior. And we never chart on it. We never really care plan for it. And ultimately, the longer someone was in a facility with that behavior, if you looked at their care plan and stuff, it was not even there. They just said, you know, it wasn't even addressed anywhere in the record. So that being said, we did see this with Dave 2. We have a lot more things that we're going to be looking at in Section E, and certainly we've taken a different approach to it. But one of the things with training, when you go back and you work with your facilities or corporations or whoever and whomever you're teaching, you need to go back to the basics with the staff and say, this message, you must track your behaviors. The other thing I meant to say was tracking the behaviors. You know, so often we call psych in and say, finally, like they'll hit a breaking point where staff's like, I can't stand the behavior any longer. And now they call psych in and they say, you know, their behavior's escalated, they're doing this, they're doing that, they're doing other thing. And inevitably, if psych goes back to the record and looks at the record, what do they find? Nothing. So now they've increased meds because you've told them everything that's going on. They have no supportive documentation in the record, but they still go ahead and, you know, based off of maybe what they're seeing and what you're telling them. And then the state comes in and doing survey, what do you think? Right? I'm not here to teach about state survey process and all of that, but just think about all of these components when they feed in. So it's too easy for us to say, well, that's just that person and get used to it. We must take the opportunity and track it. And it's going to be important to look at some of these things, more important certainly with 3.0. So think about your systems and processes. How do you change the behaviors in your own nursing homes to make sure that you're capturing these behaviors so that we can accurately code the MDS? Okay. That was my soapbox for today. Hopefully you won't have too many more of these soapboxes. All right. So let's actually go back here. So this item set, E0100, if you look at the MDS item set, it says psychosis on it. But in fact, we've changed the title in the manual to say potential indicators of psychosis. And at some point when we can get in and change the item set, that label in the item set will change to this. So when you go in to code this item, get your head around the fact that we're looking at potential indicators of psychosis. And why was that changed? That was changed from comments from folks like you. And they say, you know, they felt very strongly that these were not absolute, they weren't just indicators. They felt like by when we just said psychosis that we were kind of coming up with a diagnosis here. So they really wanted us to change the verbiage to potential indicators for psychosis. So in fact, it is the same when you go to your item set and you're looking at the manual, even though the titles are different, the item set is the same. Okay, so E100 is potential indicators of psychosis, and we're looking to identify whether a resident exhibits these behaviors. And we're looking at a couple of behaviors here, and we're looking at hallucinations, and that's the perception of the presence of something that is not actually there. And it may be auditory, it may be visual, or it may involve smells, tastes, or touch. So these are what we're defining hallucinations. And a delusion is a fixed false belief that's not shared by others that the resident holds even in the face of evidence to the contrary. And we are going to talk about delusions a little bit more as we go into section E here. So psychotic symptoms may be associated with, and I think everyone would agree with this, a delirium, dementia. It could be associated with an adverse drug reaction. It may be associated with a well-known and established psychiatric disorder. And it may be caused by or exacerbated by hearing or visual impairment. So these are some of the things that maybe we can help augment by if we can get someone a properly functioning hearing aid or an amplifying device, this may help the resident with some of these symptoms. So let's talk a little bit about hallucinations and delusions. They may be distressing to the resident or the families. They may cause a disability. They may lead to dangerous behaviors or possible harm. And they may interfere with the delivery of medical, nursing, rehabilitative, and personal care. So let's spend a few minutes just talking about hallucinations. So do we treat every hallucination? What do you think? What's your feeling about treating hallucinations? Anyone? No? Okay. Well, let's think about this. I will share a piece of personal information with you. My dad had Lewy body dementia. Does anyone know anything about Lewy body dementia? Okay. What are some of the hallmark signs of Lewy body dementia? What do they present with? Do they have hallucinations? Are they a hallmark? What kinds of hallucinations do they tend to have? There's kind of a hallmark feature for Lewy body. They hallucinate about children and animals. Those are their two. They can hallucinate obviously about other things. But they tend to hallucinate about children and animals. And they have these very vivid hallucinations. All right. So my dad had Lewy body dementia. Now, anyone who knows anything about Lewy body dementia, we know that using first-tier antipsychotics is an absolute no-no. And even if you had to use any sort of an antipsychotic going to atypical antipsychotics, you would have to go so very low and so very slow. Because of their Parkinsonian components of the Lewy body dementia, they can have really catastrophic outcomes. So that being said, we probably don't want to just generally treat hallucinations in that type of person. But my dad had hallucinations constantly, always had hallucinations. He kept himself very happily entertained he lived with my husband and I, my mom, and he would sit in his, he had this great chair downstairs in his big old room that he liked to watch TV and stuff, and you'd watch him, and he'd be going, he had a big grin on his face and whatever. My dad loved children. Well, what he was doing, I asked him, I said, what's up? And he was playing peekaboo, which he loved to do with my kids and stuff when they were little. And he was playing peekaboo with the kids. And couldn't I see them? Well, I couldn't see them, but I entered his reality. That's fine. He was very happy. Would you want to treat something like that? Okay. How about if someone felt like they had an archangel sitting on their shoulder, and they just felt like so loved and comforted from that hallucination? Would you want to treat that? No. If they were fearful and crying and cowering because they saw spiders, oof, or snakes, which I couldn't stand, around them, would that be something that you might want to treat? Right. So you want to look at, you know, is it distressing to the resident? Is it upsetting to the resident? So we don't always just go jumping to treating hallucinations. But we certainly would want to monitor to make sure that how is the resident responding to these hallucinations? And do these hallucinations interfere with the delivery of the medical or nursing care? So if they're so distressed that every time you go to provide care, personal care or something to someone, they can't process what's going on, and all of a sudden, you know, they're seeing you as a monster coming at them, and now you can't even provide general care, then that's something that we probably want to look at to go ahead and treat. All right. So how are we going to go ahead and figure out what's going on with this resident? Well, we're going to conduct an assessment. We're going to review their medical record. Now, reviewing the medical record in the facility I introduced you to, would it be helpful? No, it really wouldn't be, would it, in general? How about your own facilities? You don't need to answer this. But think about either facilities you consult in if you're a consultant or you're regional or you're actually working in a facility itself. Could you count and be confident that if you went into the medical record, you would have some of these things that we talked about documented during your look back period? If you can, good for you. The rest of you are pretty quiet, and I'm assuming that, yeah, maybe not so totally confident. So you want to certainly look at that. We want to interview staff members and others. We want to observe the resident in a variety of settings if we can. We certainly want to see how they interact during conversations. And then here again, how did they do during your structured interviews? Do you see how all of these things feed into each other? Nothing in MDS 3.0 should really be done in isolation. So if you were the one who was doing the interviews, let's say your system and processing in your facility was one person was going to do all of the interviews, well, certainly you want to look and reflect back, how did the resident do during those interviews? And it may help to inform for this item. And listen for statements indicating hallucinations or delusions. Who are they talking to? You know, if they're sitting in their room and they're all by themselves and they're carrying on a full conversation, maybe they're having auditory hallucinations. So we have to be observant to try to figure out what's going on with our residents. All right. We want to clarify potential false beliefs. So we'll try to verify facts. So this is really now, trying to clarify potential false beliefs is really getting more into your delusion. So we talked quite a bit already about hallucinations. Now we're going to start talking about delusions. So we're going to try to verify facts to determine if it's likely that the belief is false, and determine if the false belief can be corrected by a simple explanation and that's verifiable or real fact, or demonstrate the evidence to the contrary. So let's think about the scenario. This is another scenario that's come up frequently. So a resident will say something about their, either a mother or a husband, and you gently, because you know this resident so well, you can gently remind them that person had passed. Now, we don't normally do that unless you know the resident. And the resident's like, oh, that's right, yeah, I buried my husband Jimmy 22 years ago, but I really love Jimmy, and I miss him very much, and blah, 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 blah. Not distressing to them, but, you know, for that person, that delusion wasn't fixed. They very easily were kind of reminded and brought back, and they knew that person had passed. So you have to do this gently, and you certainly have to decide per resident. We don't want to say to someone who has, you know, dementia and who's pretty far along in that, you know, they're calling for the mother, and you tell them their mother has died and is dead, and now they're grieving all over again. We certainly don't want to cause that kind of distress. But there are those that who you gently can remind them or give them a piece of information that clicks in their head, and they say, oh, that's right, they've already passed. So offer a potential alternative explanation to gauge the resident's response and determine if the belief is fixed. And we're going to go through, there's some really good scenarios for today, and we'll go through those, and I think you'll see how this is clearly identified. So we are going to do not code a false belief as a delusion if the belief cannot be objectively shown to be false. So if you can't verify whether it's true or not, you can't say that delusion is false. For those of you who, I think most of you were here yesterday when I spoke about the guy who was the spy, right? I thought he was delusional. For that piece of his assessment, he was not delusional. Those were true. He obviously had other, I mean, he still thought he was working, and he thought he would go to work. He would get every day his briefcase and go, and he would call for his car. I mean, he had other delusions that were fixed. But the one about being a spy actually was true. It wasn't a delusion. It's not, so you don't want to code it if it's not possible to determine whether it is false, and the resident expresses a false belief but easily accepts a reasonable alternative explanation. And again, we'll give some examples as we go along. Do code a false belief as a delusion if the resident continues to insist the belief is correct despite an explanation or direct evidence to the contrary. So that person who thinks they must get home to feed their babies, you know, they've got to get home, they're very distressed. Their kids are at home, they got to get home to them, who's going to feed them, who's going to do the laundry, and no matter whatever kind of gentle re-guidance, redirection and whatnot, it is a fixed false belief for that person. And first and foremost, I think we all know this, don't challenge our residents. You know, you're never going to win an argument with someone with dementia. There are people who believe they can win these arguments. Have you ever seen it? Yeah, I mean, you know, you're never going to win the argument. And inevitably, I walk on units, I go throughout facilities, I've seen it in my own life, and people want to argue. My mom argued with my father. She didn't understand his dementia, even though I tried to educate her. And she argued with him. I'm like, Mom, he's not in our reality. She's like, why does he keep telling you to go get the sheep? Well, he lived in Ireland. He had a farm, you know? So I used to go get the sheep. And she said, are you nuts? And I'm like, he's distressed that the sheep are going. And guess what? You lose one or two sheep or three sheep, that's your profit for the year. So I used to go in the living room, this room, and I'd go and I'd get the sheep. And I'd bring all the sheep back into the pen. My mother thought I was as nutty as he was. And then she would... And then I'd say, okay, Dad, and he's like, get that one. And I'd go get that one, and I'd bring it back in, and I'd close it all up. And then all of a sudden, you could watch him visibly relax. And I'm like, are they all in? Yeah, good job, Ann. Or no, he didn't say Ann, he'd say good job. He didn't know who I was at that point. But good job. So my mom would just shake her head and walk away. She didn't understand. So even though I really tried hard, the other thing is, I bring that point up too, because sometimes we really have to spend a lot of time with our family members to help them to understand these delusions and understand the dementia and understand that people are not doing it to them and what's going on. All right. So, coding instruction. So we're going to code based on behaviors observed and or thoughts expressed in the look-back period, 7-day look-back period. So we're looking at that 7-day period of time. Someone may have a behavior that they normally present hallucinations or delusions, but we are really, sometimes, that will not be expressed during that 7-day period of time. So if they're not having hallucinations during that 7-day period of time, we're not coding it here. If they had it at day 15, that's fine, but if it's not during that 7-day look-back period, we're not coding it. And do not code based on the presence of a medical diagnosis. So we're not saying, well, they have a diagnosis of hallucinations. We really are looking for the actual, are they having hallucinations during this time frame? And then this happens to be a check all that applies. So someone could have both hallucinations and delusions, or they could have one or the other, or they could have none of the above, which is a Z code. So let's look at some of the scenarios here for this section. So a resident carries on a one-sided conversation mentioning her daughter's name as if she's addressing her in person. When asked about this, she reports hearing her daughter's voice even though the daughter is not present and no other voices can be heard in the environment. All right? So we are going to code what? Hallucinations. Okay. So because she reports the, you know, you kind of hear her talking to this person and there's no one else there, that she actually has the, we're going to code that we have the hallucinations. All right. So now we have, a resident reports that he heard a gunshot. In fact, there was a loud knock on the door, or it could have been a slamming door or whatever. When this is explained to him, he accepts the alternative interpretation of the loud noise. So he said, you know, you hear this bang. He said, oh, I heard a gunshot. And you say, oh, no, Mr. Jones, that wasn't a gunshot. That was someone slamming a door. Oh, okay, I thought it was a gunshot. So how would we code this person? Z, right, because, you know, they thought it was a gunshot, but when we gave them the explanation, they said, no, all right, I accept what you're telling me, that alternate explanation. Very good. Okay, so we would code that person as Z. All right, so now let's look at another coding scenario. So a resident announces that he must leave to go to work, because he is needed in the office right away. And in fact, he's been retired for 15 years. When reminded of this, he continues to insist that he must go to his office. So what would we code that? B, right, he had a fixed delusion. We tried to say, you know, you've been retired, you don't need to go to the office, but he insists. That would be all of us nurses, right? Got to get the MBSs done. Got to get to the office. I always say that if I ever end up in a nursing home, man, I'll be one of those people, I'll be pushing everyone, I'll be untying restraints, I'll be auditing medical records, I'll be directing everyone what to do. I'll be the worst nightmare. Oh, well. Okay, so let's move on. Here we have E200, behavioral symptoms and presence and frequency. So now we're going to get into a little bit more meat. So we've determined that maybe the person has hallucinations and delusions. Now we're going to move on here. So the new onset of behavioral symptoms warrant a prompt evaluation. And we talked about that yesterday when we were looking at the CAM. We have to decide, you know, this may be an acute delirium. So if it's new onset, let's look at it. It either could be an indication of a delirium. It could be an issue that they suddenly have pain. There could be something else going on with the resident, so we need to try to figure that out. So it needs prompt evaluation, assurance of the resident's safety. So if all of a sudden someone who never was exit-seeking is all of a sudden exit-seeking, that's a problem for us, right? Yeah, so we need to be aware of that. We need to warrants relief of distressing symptoms if we can, certainly if we pain management or medications, and compassionate response to the resident. We need to reassure them and bring them comfort. We need to identify and treat reversible and treatable causes promptly, certainly treat pain, treat any infections, and develop a management strategies to minimize the amount of disability or distress, both to the resident and to the environment. So if we can figure out what's going on with them and go ahead and treat. We also need to determine the presence of problematic behaviors. And so here we're saying these behaviors may be physical or verbal, or the problem behaviors may be directed towards the resident self or towards others. So now you see we're getting into a little bit more of the meat of it. So someone may have a behavior that's self-directed, or they may have a behavior that's directed at other residents or at staff or other people. So for any identified behavior, we must determine the frequency of the behavior. How often are they having this behavior? And then the impact of the behavior on the self and others. So now we're starting to put the framework in place for doing this section. So it assesses for the presence of the behavior only. And again, we reiterate the fact that we are not going to consider the intent of the behavior, just whether the behavior is present or not. So physical behavior is directed towards others. can include, this is not an exhaustive list, and people really struggled with this when we did the April training. So they said, oh, I can only code if they have these behaviors. No, we're giving you some examples of some of the behaviors that may be directed towards others. Hitting, kicking, pushing, scratching, grabbing, abusing others sexually. Any one of these behaviors or a combination of these behaviors or anything else you can think of. These happen to be the list that we put together for this presentation. Verbal behaviors directed towards others. They may threaten others. They may curse at others. They may scream at others. We've never seen these behaviors before, have we? No. It's amazing. It truly is amazing when you look at some of our residents, you know, especially with the cognitive impairments as they go through, you know, their ability has lessened to filter. It's amazing what has come forward and can be quite distressing to family members and to others when all of a sudden their mother, who is prim and proper, who would have never sworn, all of a sudden has a mouth like a truck driver. Yeah. I actually had a nun, a sister from a local order in the nursing home where I was a director. And everyone taught me, she, you know, people had, they were an order of teaching nuns. And so many people had her as an instructor. And they said she was just, you know, she's a little bit of a thing. She only stood about this high and just very sweet and caring. Everyone loved her. And she ended up with a cognitive impairment and some other issues. And she ended up in the nursing home where I was. And it was so distressing to everyone because what came out of this woman's mouth was hardcore truck drivers. I mean, and I'm not saying against truck drivers. It was a really, you know, it was very distressing to anyone who came to visit her, and actually distressing a little bit to some of the staff because they knew this person, who she was. So we may have these behaviors happening. So other behaviors directed towards others, so it could be hitting or scratching self. Other behaviors not directed towards others could be hitting or scratching themselves. It could be pacing, rummaging, someone with public sexual acts, disrobing in public, throwing or smearing food or bodily fluids, screaming, disruptive sounds. And please note, when we're looking at this section here in E200, we're not looking at wandering. And we're not looking at wandering because, as you're going to find out as you go along, in Section E, we have a whole section for wandering. So we're not, when you're coding this item, you have to make sure that we kind of take wandering piece out of it and hold it off to the side until we get to those questions. So again, we're going to review the medical record. We're going to interview staff across all shifts and disciplines. We're going to talk to family, friends, or people who come to visit on a regular basis. And we're going to look at the resident in a variety of settings. And we're going to code whether the symptoms occurred during the time frame. Do not code any interpretations of the meaning or the cause of the behavior. All right, so now we've said this seven different ways. Intent doesn't matter, in case you didn't get that message. And code any behavior that occurs, even if the staff have become used to the behavior. This is going to be your hardest, again, this is going to be your hardest part. You are not going to have, because you're looking at that seven-day period of time, and, you know, you're just not going to have the documentation anywhere, and it's going to be really hard. And you're going to have to talk to staff and really try to get this information out. So that's singularly going to be your biggest challenge when you go back to your organizations, to get staff to put the systems and processes and auditing in place to make sure that you get this accurate documentation. The main reason behind that is because the behavior becomes typical or tolerable for the staff. And then we're going to include behaviors that might represent a rejection of care. And we're going to talk a little bit about the rejection of care as a separate coded item as we move on. So let's look at E200. We have the types of behavior the resident exhibited. And hopefully either you have your MDS in front of you, these slides, and you can read them. But the coding methodology is to the left, and it says the behavior not exhibited, so you'd put a 0. Or you're going to put a 1, the behavior of this type occurred 1 to 3 days. The behavior occurred 4 to 6 days, but not daily. And then the behavior of this type occurred daily. So think about your average medical record. You know, it's going to be kind of hard, right, if you go back and you don't have any of these things documented. Or if you haven't documented, how do we come up with accurate to know whether it's 1 to 3 days that they had it, up to 6 days, or whether they had it daily? We are going to be looking at the items of physical behavior symptoms directed towards others, verbal behavioral symptoms directed towards others, and then other behavioral symptoms not directed towards others, and we're going to go through those. So here's the frequency. We just talked about that. So let's look at the frequency scenario here. So every morning, a nursing assistant tries to help a resident who is unable to dress himself. On the last four out of the six mornings, the resident has hit or scratched the nursing assistant during attempts to dress him. So we have four out of six mornings, they're hitting, scratching, as the staff member is trying to do care. So how are we going to code 200A? Right. Okay, 200A, because of the scratching, the nursing assistant is a physical behavior directed towards other. We're going to code the response option 2 because the behavior occurred for at least 4 days, but not daily, so that 4 to 6 day period of time. All right, so that makes sense, hopefully. So a resident has previously been found rummaging through clothes in her roommate's dresser drawers. And the behavior has not been observed by the staff or reported by others in the last 7 days. So she has a history of rummaging through her roommate's drawers, but we haven't seen it in the last 7 days. How are we going to code it? Right. Okay, so that makes sense, right? It didn't happen in the last 7 days. All right, so we're going to code it 0. So a resident throws his dinner tray at another resident who repeatedly spit food at him during dinner. We've never seen this behavior, have we? Yeah. This is a single isolated incident. All right, so we have a resident throwing his dinner tray at another resident because that resident repeatedly spit out his food. So how are we going to code this behavior? A, right, coding it as 1. Occurred 1 to 3 days. It only happened the once. Although possible explanations exist for the behavior is noted as a person because it occurred during the look-back period. So even though someone could say, well, you know what, Ann, he was justified in doing that. Man, it was really gross what the guy was doing. You know, okay, that's fine. Probably need to switch up their dining assignments and see what's going on here. But it happened, and it happened during the 7-day look-back period. So even though that's not the normal behavior for this particular resident, he did display this behavior. So we will code it as 1, the physical behavior symptom directed towards other, because he threw the tray at another person. All right, so let's look at 0300, overall presence of behavioral symptoms. So the purpose behind E300 is to confirm whether the problematic behavior had been documented in E200. So this determines whether the completed items, it determines if the item E500 and 600 need to be completed. So it's kind of, as I've talked already the last couple of days, there are some what I call bridging questions, and this is one of them. Were any behavioral symptoms in question 0200 coded as 1, 2, or 3? So if E200 has a 1, 2, or 3, then we're going to answer yes here, and we're going to go ahead, and then we're going to answer further questions. If no, we skip to 800. So if they didn't have any, it makes sense, right? If they don't have any behaviors, we're going to skip out of the rest of these items. So review the coding for E200 and confirm whether you have any of these answers, 1, 2, or 3. If you have all zeros in there, skip forward to 800. So we're going to code no, we go forward, and we answer the question as E800, rejection of care. So once we've answered that bridging question, and again, these are kind of going to set us up for our skip patterns, but let's say yes, we have a behavior, now we're going to go on to E500 and 600. And what we're going to look at in these questions is what is the impact of the behaviors that we've identified on the residents or others. So the behaviors identified in 200 can create a risk for illness or injury, interfere with the provision of care, and that's probably, you know, very, very common for us. Interfere with participation in activities or social activities. So if someone has a socially inappropriate or not accepted behavior, doesn't it make it really hard for them to go to group activities? So even if you have, you know, this very large music activity and someone is constantly calling out, it can make it really hard for them to be able to participate in that activity. It may intrude on the privacy. of others, and it may be disruptive to the living environment. So when we are looking at this, consider the previous review in E200, and we're going to look at medical records, we're going to talk to staff, we're going to interview, and look at observations. Those are a constant theme that you're going to hear through this. For E500, we're looking at the impact on the resident in the first question. So E500 says, determine the impact on the resident is there a significant risk of physical illness or injury? Is there a significant interference with the resident's care? So whatever behavior they're doing, how is it impacting the resident and us being able to provide care to them? And does it significantly interfere with participation in activities or social interactions? So that's what we're looking back with E500. We are going to look at determine the impact on others, and we are going to look at, does it put the resident at significant physical risk? Does it significantly intrude on privacy or activities? And does it significantly disrupt care of the living environment? So 500, think about this, 500 is how does it impact the resident, 600 is how does it impact everyone else. Consider all behavioral symptoms coded in E200 and the presence and frequency, and staff should use clinical judgment in determining the significance of the behavior for each resident. I want to spend a moment about the word significant. In the original, if someone looked at, I don't even know what version of the manual that was put out, we actually had a definition of significant that was like from the Webster Dictionary, and it was not really relative to, it was this vague definition that people couldn't get their arms around. And so we spent a lot of time in our team trying to define the word significant for everyone. And what we realized in spending some time in talking to Dr. Deb Saliba and various other people is the significance, whether something is significant, needs to be a clinical judgment. Yeah, you have to decide how significant it is, related to the whole environment and everything that's going on with the resident. So you will not find a definition for the word significant, except for that it says you must look at your total environment, the impact of it, and based off of your clinical judgment. All right? So there's not a black and white. This is up for you guys to decide how important or how severe this particular behavior is. So focus on the impact of the behavior on the resident. In each one of these questions, where it's asking a, is it no or yes, zero or one? So when we're looking at 0500, we want to say, a resident frequently grabs and scratches staff when they attempt to change her soiled brief, digging her nails into their skin, and this makes it difficult to complete the care task. All right? So the impact we're asking here is, there's three questions that we're looking at. Is did any of the identified symptoms put the resident at significant risk for physical illness or injury? So scratching the caregiver, did it put the resident at risk for physical illness or injury? No. But it may, right? I don't know this resident. But, so you guys get to make the determination. If they absolutely refuse to have their brief taken off and you can't even get to them, they could end up with skin breakdown, right? I mean, we don't know. So please take into consideration, we came up with the most common answer here, but that doesn't mean that this is an end-all and be-all. You have to go back and say, for this resident, in this situation, it's so bad that yes, in fact, we as a clinical team have determined that scratching, hitting, and whatever is so bad that it really does put the person at risk for physical illness or injury. So you may answer that question as a yes. Does it significantly interfere with the resident's care? That's an obvious yes, right? Okay. And does it significantly interfere with the resident's participation in activities or social interactions? We said, you know, if we were coding this, probably not, but it may. If they stink to high heaven and no one will let them anywhere, you know what I mean? Have you ever come across someone like that? Right? They just won't let you, you know, clean them. I mean, you've really got to work hard until you can get to that point where you can clean them? It may. So I think that these, we're giving you examples and some of the most obvious solutions here. But again, when you teach this and when you get your staff used to this, you, as the clinical team, get to determine the significance of each one of these and then kind of justify it out somewhere in your record why you think that this is important or why you would think that it would impact their illness and injury. So let's do a practice scenario here. A resident paces insistently. The staff encourage him to sit at the dinner table. He returns to pacing after less than a minute, even after cueing and reminders. He is so restless that he cannot sit still long enough to feed himself or receive assistance in obtaining adequate nutrition. So you got the scenario for this guy or woman? Okay. So how are we going to code this person? So you'd have to look at the questions. We have three questions that we're looking at here. All right, you got your answer? Okay. So we're going to code E500A as significant risk for physical illness or injury. Well, in this determination, they said yes. Why would you say yes here? Right, his nutrition and stuff, right? Okay. Very good. We're going to code 500B, significantly interferes with the resident's care. Yes, because, you know, feeding is part of, you know, helping someone to eat and feed certainly could put them at risk for malnutrition and physical illness. And it could put the resident at risk, interfering with our ability to help that resident eat and whatnot. Now, certainly there are strategies and things that we could put in place for that person. You know, eating on the fly, that person where you're constantly giving a quarter of a sandwich as they're pacing and whatnot. There's many residents I've seen that have taken in quite a bit of calories with staff who's really diligent in keeping them feeding and eating as they're walking. All right, so now we have another situation. And again, we're looking at the impact of the resident. A resident repeatedly throws his marker and cards on the floor during bingo. So how are we going to code this resident? Everyone got your answer? Yeah? Okay. So really what we're looking for here is E500C. It significantly interferes with the resident's participation in activities or social interactions. So that person may be shunned from the bingo room if they're acting out. Because, you know, bingo is a serious... We don't want to mess with the bingo people. Nothing interferes with bingo. All right. So this behavior could interfere with the resident's ability to participate in the activity. But again, that's a clinical judgment. I mean, you guys have to, it may not be an issue for the resident, but you guys get to determine that based off of observation and interaction. All right. So let's talk about E600, the impact on others. Again, it's a yes-no question, and each item requires that you enter either a 0 or a 1, no or yes. So we looked at the 500 was what was the impact upon the resident. Now we're looking at what is the impact of the behavior on others. So let's look at another scenario here. When eating in the dining room, a resident frequently grabs food off the plates of other residents. Although their food is replaced so that the behavior does not compromise the nutrition of other residents, the other residents become anxious in anticipation of this recurring behavior. So again, have you guys ever seen that behavior? Yep. You got to place them so they're greater than arm's length away from each other, right? All right. So let's look at, we have three questions that we have to answer. We would say there's A, B, and C. We would code B and C, meaning that 600B is because the behavior violates other residents' privacy and is an intrusion on their personal space and property, meaning their food tray, you know, their ability to eat. And then C is because the behavior is pervasive and disrupts the staff's ability to deliver nutritious meals in the dining room, meaning they're constantly having to address this issue with this particular resident, go get other food, bring it to the current resident. So in this scenario, we coded yes both for B and C in the impact on other residents. Here's another scenario. A resident, when sitting in the hallway outside the community activity room, continually yells, repeating the same phrase. The yelling can be heard by other residents in the hallway and activity in recreational areas, but not in their private rooms. So this person's sitting there, they're calling out a repetitive phrase, not an unheard behavior. So how would we code 600 here? Just take a second. Think about what we're looking at here. Everyone have an answer? Okay. So we're going to code 600B as significantly intrudes on the privacy and activity of others because this calling out affects other people. And then we're looking at 600C. We're going to say yes, because it really is totally disrupting, or can be disruptive to the full living environment. But it doesn't put the others at risk for significant injury. That calling out doesn't put them at risk. It could put the resident at risk if another resident whacks them over the head with their cane, right? Which, again, you can't make this stuff up. I've seen a guy had to have 13 stitches across the top of his head. The behavior does not create a climate of excessive noise disruptive to the living environment and the activity, or does create, I'm sorry. So it's disruptive to the whole living environment. All right, so a resident appears to intentionally stick out his cane when other residents walk by. What do you think of that one? We had fun with this one. Okay, so you got a resident sitting there, and he's sticking out his cane. Fun, fun, fun. So how are we going to code this item? Okay, everyone got your answer? Okay, so we're going to code E600A, put others at significant risk for physical injury. Absolutely, right? I mean, if you trip someone and they fall, yeah. The behavior puts other residents at risk for falling and physical injury. But you may also need to consider coding 600B and 600C depending on the specific situation in the environment or the care setting. So the obvious answer was A, yes, they put others at risk. But again, just like when you looked at the other questions, you certainly need to look at B and C, because depending on how they're doing it and where they're doing it, this may disrupt the whole environment. If people are having to bypass that hallway or wherever that person's sitting and, you know, walk an extra mile to get to the activity room, it could be very disruptive to the whole environment, right? All right. But you guys get to determine that based off of your assessment of the resident. All right, so let's spend a little bit of time on E800. Now, I will preface going into this item as when we trained on this in April, people struggled with this a little bit, so hopefully I'm going to try to explain what some of the concerns were, and I'm hoping that you'll be comfortable encoding this item by the time we're done this morning. So we're looking at rejection of care and the presence and the frequency of that activity. So, goals for health and well-being. The goals for health and well-being reflect the residents' wishes and objectives, and this is an important point, for the health, function, and life satisfaction that define an acceptable quality of life for the individual. So, what for that person, for me, if I was a resident in your nursing home, or any one of your residents, what's my kind of my ultimate goal? What is it that I, what are my wishes, what are my objectives for health and function? Like if I want to go out and I'm a COPD-er and I'm on my oxygen and I want to go out and smoke, because I've smoked my whole life, although I'm a non-smoker, but let's say I did and that was really important for me, even though I know it's not good for my health and stuff, for me it's a quality of life issue and I want to do that. And we certainly see that all the time, right? You know, people who want it, who make these decisions and choices. The resident care preferences will reflect desires, wishes, inclinations, or choices for care. And the preferences do not have to appear logical or rational to the clinician. And similarly, preferences are not necessarily informed by fact or scientific knowledge and may not be consistent with good judgment. So we need to take all of these things into consideration when we're answering this item. So rejection of care may be manifested by verbally declining or a statement of refusal. I don't want to shower, ever. Or, you know, I don't want to shower today or whatever. Physical behavior that convey aversion to or result in the avoidance of or interference with the receipt of care. So really that's saying that person who's fighting you, when you're trying to do care, they're screaming. You're trying to get them into the shower, and they're like grabbing on, or they're fighting at you, and they're kicking and hitting, and they're very distressed. So they're not saying necessarily the words and having this conversation with you, but you get the message. They're not happy with what you're trying to do. So this type of behavior interrupts or interferes with the delivery of the receipt of care, and it disrupts the usual routines and processes by which care is given, and it exceeds the level of intensity or resources that are usually available for the provision of care. So that's these are the behaviors where it takes two staff members, sometimes three staff members, to provide care, because as you're going to wash, the resident's giving you a right hook, so that you need someone to gently kind of calm them down, maybe hold their hands so that they're not hitting at a person or scratching. These are labor-intensive types of residents. All right. They may take a lot of negotiation to get them to think about and consider that, they'll take a shower on the fourth Sunday when there's a quarter moon, and, whatever it is, and you negotiate these things out, and then they decide that maybe that's not what they want to do and they're going to wait for the full moon, whatever. I mean, there's some really crazy things, but, think about some of these residents that you've cared for and how much time and effort that you've spent with them, trying to make sure that we can provide the care and keep them safe and healthy and well, clean and whatnot, and yet not force upon them the care, that you get them to a point that they agree and can go along with us, and that it's kind of hopefully a win-win situation out of it. Residents might reject or decline care because care conflicts with preferences or goals. So this is not considered a problem that warrants treatment or modifies or eliminates behavior. So let's talk just for a second about that. So if I'm rejecting care because it conflicts with a preference or goal, if I'm saying to you, I'm not taking a shower, and you're like, but you gotta take a shower, and you're gonna take a shower because you're in room 14C and your shower's at 11 o'clock on Tuesdays. Have you ever been in a facility like that? Okay. Or your shower is an evening shower, and days already have too many showers. All right? So you have to have your shower on 3 to 11. And they want to do the shower at 4:20, and then you got to get in your Johnny coat. Even though there's an evening activity on Tuesday nights, every Tuesday night there's an activity. So I'm rejecting the care. Because why? Not what I want. I don't want to take a shower in the evening. Maybe I was a morning shower or bather or whatever my whole life. Why would all of a sudden I start taking a shower in the evening? I don't care about your staffing patterns. I don't care. I'm in room 15-2, and I'm supposed to have a 3 to 11 shower. It doesn't matter to me. I really don't care. I know that I would like to take a shower in the morning. And anyway, even if you wanted me to take a 3 to 11 shower, it's not going to be on a Tuesday, because I like to go to the Tuesday activities. So, we have to figure out, what is it? Why is that person rejecting that care? And then we need to work through and say, all right, well, gosh, if it's just an issue of Tuesday or Wednesday, that's no big deal. It may be a little bit of a bigger deal to get it as a morning shower versus an evening shower, or maybe they want to shower at 2:30 in the afternoon. I don't know. We need to work it through with the resident and try to figure it out. Residents might reject care due to an underlying neuropsychiatric, medical, or dental problem. So we need to figure out what's going on with the person, and it can interfere with the needed care consistent with the resident's preferences and established goals. So if the resident's all of a sudden not eating, and they're refusing, they're basically just taking fluids in, but they're refusing to eat food, it may be because they've got an abscess, a dental abscess, because it hurts to eat. And we have to figure that out. Or they may have a broken tooth or something like that. So it may be a problem that requires an assessment and intervention. So that's our job, to be the detectives and to figure out how can we provide the care in the best environment. All right, so now let's look at, is it really a matter of a resident? So is the rejection of care, like I've talked about earlier, really a matter of the resident's choice? And if so, we need to figure out how to make it happen for them. And so when a behavior, now this is where it kind of got to be a sticky wicket in April. So When a person first has a rejection of care, we may need to code it as a behavior. So let's say all of a sudden they're rejecting whatever it is. Let's use showers or bathing. And so we need to code that behavior. The team investigates and determine that the rejection or the decline of care is really a matter of resident choice. And then we need to provide education, and the resident choice becomes part of the plan of care. On further assessments, the behavior would not be coded in this item. Does that seem reasonable to you guys? Does that get a sense with that? Okay, so the person rejects the care. Now that they've rejected the care, whatever it is, we're going to go ahead and investigate, figure it out, offer alternatives. But if for whatever reason they're going to continue to reject the care, not a problem. As long as we've gone ahead and we've care planned for it, we've provided education, and we realize that it's really an informed choice. Even though we may not agree with it, it's an informed choice for the resident. The next time that we go ahead and do the MDS, that particular behavior does not get coded on that next MDS as a rejection of care. All right? We'll give some examples, but that was the sticking point in April, and hopefully we've explained that. So we're going to interview staff across all the shifts. We're going to interview others who have had a close interaction with the resident. We're going to review the record, and we're going to determine whether rejected care is needed to achieve the resident's goals and preferences for health and well-being. So, for example, if the rejection of care is suddenly to stop eating, and this has been a person who's been very clear that they want to continue to live, be fit, enjoy food, maybe are passionate about food, have never had an issue before, and this is like, you're sitting there saying, well, wait a minute, this person always ate. This was never an issue. This is so different from them that it's not part of what we knew as this person and their goals. Then that rejection of care would be a different issue. It doesn't match with what that person wants. So was the care rejection behavior previously addressed and documented in discussions in the care planning with the resident, family, or significant others? Was it determined to be an informed choice consistent with the resident's values, preferences, and goals? So you think about your documentation here, right, folks? How are we going to have these discussions? What are we going to put in the medical record? And does the behavior represent an objection to the way care is provided, but acceptable alternative care or approaches to care have been identified or employed? So let's go through another example looking at that last bullet. If someone refuses to take a shower, they're never taking a shower, but they'll bathe, at the sink, and they go to the hairdressers every week. Have you ever met someone who never took a shower? Right? Some of our 1900-year-olds, showers wasn't a part of their life, right? Okay, some people always took a tub bath. They don't want the shower. They don't want the water coming down on top. They want a tub bath. Well, all we need to do is ask the question, because guess what? Can we give them a tub bath? Sure we can. So it's not that they're saying, I don't want to be clean. It's saying, I don't want to take a shower. So a tub bath is an alternative for me, or I want to clean myself at the sink and do all of that and do my hair at the hairdressers. So we come up with an alternative plan for that particular person. If the resident exhibits behavior that appears to communicate a rejection of care, ask directly if the behavior is meant to decline or refuse care. If the resident indicates that the intention of that intention, ask about the reason for rejecting the care and about the goals for health care and well-being. So all this is saying is, guys, you're obligated to go ahead and do kind of due diligence and figure out what's going on with this resident. If the resident's unable or unwilling to respond to the question about rejection of care goals for health care and well-being, you want to talk to the family or significant others to ascertain the resident's health care preferences and goals. So if the resident's not able to communicate with you clearly, then you want to spend some time talking to the family or significant others and say, has this been a lifelong pattern? Maybe they were, have we ever known those people who really were just disheveled and really weren't that clean and whatever. I mean, this was kind of who they were their whole life prior to coming into the nursing home. This may be their baseline. We have to figure this out. The intent is to identify potential behavior problems, not rejection of care based on choice. Again, you're going to keep seeing this. If it's the resident choice, it's of informed decision, informed choice, then it's not. Once we've worked through all of that, then it won't be a rejection of care. And do not include behaviors that have already been addressed, and determine to be consistent with the resident's values, preferences, and goals. So that's repeating that same statement in a variety of different ways that we talked about earlier. And the reason it's written in so many different ways is because it was a real sticking point in April. So we want to make sure if it's an informed choice, you've already educated, care planned for, come up with the whole process. The next time you have MDS 3.0, we're not going to code that as a rejection of care. So E800 is code the number of days in the look-back period that the resident exhibited rejection of care consistent with goals for health care and well-being. Do not code the number of episodes. So here a coding is the number of days, not the number of times. So days in this particular setting. All right. So here we have a resident with heart failure who recently returned to the nursing home after surgical repair of her hip fracture, is offered physical therapy and declines. She says that she gets too short of breath when she tries to walk, even short distances, making physical therapy for her intolerable. She does not expect to walk again and does not want to try. Her physician has discussed this with her and has indicated her prognosis for regaining ambulatory function is poor. So this may be a woman with an ejection fraction of like 20, who's just, the amount of energy to even just get up and get to a chair is probably enough in the day, never mind trying to walk. So here she is, she's declining physical therapy, she's accepted that she doesn't want to walk anymore, and she's discussed this with her physician. So let's look at the coding here. So this resident has communicated that she considers physical therapy to be both intolerable and futile for her. The resident discussed this with her physician, and her choice to not accept physical therapy treatment is consistent with her values and goals for healthcare. She realizes this probably was a person who really wasn't able to walk much prior to this anyway, from the way that we're kind of describing this person. Therefore, this would not be coded as rejection of care. Does that make sense to everyone? Yeah, okay, so we all agree, you know, we may think it's in her best interest, you know, especially, you know, someone that, like, you know, our physical therapists, you know, who are like, we got to get everyone up and going and keep everyone going, and that's a great philosophy to have and certainly want to keep people as mobile as possible. But in this situation, it makes a reasonable sense. Now, there may be the exact same scenario for someone else who says, I'm not giving up. I don't care I have a 20% ejection fraction. I'm going to push myself. I want to be able to walk, even if it's four steps. I want that, and I will do whatever it takes to make that happen. All right, that's fine too, okay? But we need to, you see where this is an informed choice. All right, so let's look at our little practice scenario here. Let me just get to the right page. All right, so a resident goes to bed at night without changing out of the clothes he wore during the day. When the nursing assistant offers to help him to get undressed, he declines, stating that he prefers to sleep in his clothes. The clothes are wet with urine. This happens 2 of the past 7 days. The resident was previously fastidious, recently has expressed embarrassment at being incontinent, and has care goals that include maintaining personal hygiene and skin integrity. So have we ever met someone like this person? Yeah. Okay. So what are the key components here, do you think, in this scenario? Well, whose care goals? That's a very good point. Whose care goals are they, his or ours? Well, they kind of describe this man as being this fastidious person, very, very clean and whatnot, and so this was important to him to be this way. He sounds like he's got new onset of incontinence, right? Which in and itself is a huge issue for us to try to figure out what's going on. So we have that issue that we should deal with. So this is that person who's normally perfectly kept, you know, you're probably a little gentleman, he's going down, very social, whatever. So he's embarrassed. He doesn't understand, like, why is he incontinent? I mean, and someone to care for him? Can you imagine? It's got to be very, very difficult. So what's he doing? Well, I'm just going to protect myself. I just won't let them see. It's like that person who becomes incontinent. Have you ever found that person? Usually it's women. And all of a sudden, you go in the room and you can't figure out the smell. And then you find all of their dirty clothes and underwear tucked in a corner because they're embarrassed to tell anyone that they had some incontinence. Right? Have you ever, you know, had that situation? All right. So that person is showing embarrassment of that. So it's not, they want to be clean and put together, and they're embarrassed about what's going on. All right. So how would you code 800, rejection of care, for this person? Would you say the behavior's not exhibited, that he's rejecting care? Would you say that the behavior of this type occurred 1 to 3 days, or 4 to 6 days, or that it occurred daily? Okay, and you guys got it right. It's the behavior of this type occurred 1 to 3 days. He rejected care, but that wasn't really in line with what we know this person to be. So something was abnormal. Something was going on with this person. And so he was rejecting care. We have an obligation to figure out why he's rejecting care and what we can do to help him out. There's lots that we could do. We could figure out why all of a sudden he's had incontinence, maybe he has overflow, maybe he has BPA, who knows? But we have an obligation to try to work that out. So the resident care rejection behavior is not consistent with his values and goals in health and well-being, and therefore this is classified as a care rejection that occurred on 2 days during the look-back period, so we'd code that as a 1. All right, great job, folks. All right, so let's look at another scenario here. A resident who previously ate well and prided herself on following a healthy diet has been refusing to eat every day for the past 2 weeks. All right, so we have this woman. She eats a healthy diet. It's important to her. And now here we are. She's been refusing to eat for the past 2 weeks. She complains that that the food is boring and that she feels full just after a few bites. And she says she wants to eat to maintain her weight and avoid getting sick, but she cannot push herself to eat anymore. So she's saying, I want to eat, but I can't. All right? So she's rejecting the food, but it's not consistent with what she wants. She wants to be able to eat, but she's telling you she can't eat. So how are we going to code this behavior? Anyone? 3? Okay, yeah, it happened daily. All right, so it happened daily. So the code here is 3. The resident's choice not to eat is not consistent with her goal of weight maintenance and health, because she tells you, you know, I've always wanted to eat healthy, I've continued, and she does eat healthy. Now here she can't. And choosing not to eat may be related to a medical condition, such as a disturbance of taste sensation, gastrointestinal illness, endocrine condition, depressive disorder, or medical side effects. Something happened 2 weeks ago, right? That's our job to figure out what's going on with this resident and help her to get back to, if we can, to the point where she's able to eat and maintain her health as she wishes. So here we're saying she's rejecting care. It's not a bad thing. Like, we're not judging. That's the other thing. People want to do is they think this is a judgment question. It's not. We're not judging anyone. We're saying she's rejecting the care, and then we have the bigger obligation to take this and figure out what's going on. All right. So now let's go on to E900 and E1000. And we're going to talk about wandering and specifically, and about the presence and frequency and the impact of the wandering. So wandering may be a pursuit of exercise or a pleasurable leisure activity, and it relates to tension, anxiety, agitation, or searching. And not all wandering is harmful. You guys agree with that, right? Some wandering is, but there's many people whose wandering is not harmful at all. Some residents who wander are potentially higher risk for entering into unsafe situations, and I think all of us who care for residents in the nursing home setting, we have those who just simply wander, and we have others who wander, you know, and who tend to get into, you know, more dangerous types of situations. And then some residents who wander can cause significant disruption to other residents. And certainly we see, though, those that who just, you know, kind of plow right in, they don't care, they just wander and knock into people or into things, or they wander into other people's rooms, those types of things. Determining if the wandering occurs, so that's first and foremost, is the person wandering? And we can do that by certainly observation, interviewing staff, reviewing the medical record, And then we need to say, all right, well, if they're wandering, does the wandering occur? What is the frequency during the look-back period? So how often are is the person wandering? So wandering is the act of moving, walking or locomotion in a wheelchair, from place to place without a specific course or known direction. And this becomes an issue, and again, in April, some people they really kind of want to argue this point. Some people wander and end up in the activity room because they follow the crowd. Or they may end up somewhere else. But it's not like they're saying, all right, I'm going to go consciously to the activities room or I'm going to go to the dining room. They may just wander around and all of a sudden there's three people heading that way and they follow the red shirt and they end up in the activities room. So wandering may or may not be aimless. The residents may be oblivious to his or her physical or safety needs. Not always, but they could be. The resident may have purpose such as searching to find something, but he or she persists without knowing the exact direction or location of the object, person, or place. So that may be a person who's trying to find the exit because they're trying to go home and take care of their family. They have purpose, or they're trying to go to work. Like, they don't realize that it's 2:00 in the morning and they don't work anymore. Okay, but they have this idea that they've got to find this exit to get out and to go to wherever they needed to go. The behavior may or may not be driven by confused thoughts or delusional ideas. Again, when the resident believes that he or she must find her mother, who staff know is deceased, or they got to get home to the kids. And wandering may occur even if the resident is on a locked unit. So just because they're on a secure unit, the resident may be considered to be wandering on that. And I think everyone will agree with that. I don't think there's any issues related to that. Pacing or traveling via a planned course is not wandering, so we need to figure out what's going on. So is that person literally just pacing back and forth in their room? I think most clinicians really can determine between a pacing activity and a wandering. And then traveling via a planned course is not wandering, and I think we'd all agree on that. So when we're looking at wandering, we're looking, code the number of days in the look-back period that the resident wandered, and do not code the number of episodes of wandering. So again, this is one of these things, we're looking at the number of days, not how many episodes. So did it occur no days, 1 to 3 days, 4 to 6, or daily? Common theme. So when you're teaching and educating, once people understand this frequency method for days, it's the same in many items. So they'll get used to it pretty quickly when they go to code these items. So complete this item only if E900 is coded as a 1, 2, or 3 to indicate that the resident has wandered during the look-back period. Consider the previous review of the resident's wandering behavior identified in E0900. Determine the impact of the behavior. So what we're looking here is, does this wandering put the resident at a significant risk for getting into potentially dangerous situations? So is that person exit seeking? Is that person always going towards the stairwell? Have you ever had someone like that? I've been in a couple, this one lady in this one facility, man, anyone who got near the stairwell, and they had really slow elevators, so the staff used the stairwell all the time, and this rest, she sat very quietly in her wheelchair. Man, if you didn't make sure that you shut that door behind you, you know, because it was a slow shut, and make sure that it was secure, I can't tell you how many times she would get her foot in and try to open the door and follow a staff member. And she was in a wheelchair trying to go down that. So that was a major concern for this facility, and all staff were alerted. They educated everyone who would have any opportunity to be on that unit. That this was an issue, and they strongly encouraged families and visitors to use the elevator and not to use the stairwells. And does the wandering significantly intrude on the privacy or activities of others? So is this kind of an invasive wander and they're constantly going into particular rooms, and then maybe they're doing rummaging, whatever. And determine the significance by applying critical judgment for the individual or resident. So again, here's that word significant. Are they at significant risk? Only you guys, you staff members who are doing the assessments, can determine the significance of the risk. It's up to you. You have to know the resident. And then you determine, is it significant for this resident, yes or no? So here we are looking at coding E1000A. We're going to code 0 as no, does not place the resident at significant risk, or we're going to say yes, it places the resident at significant risk for getting into dangerous places or encountering a dangerous situation. So if this person is wandering, and they could wander onto the elevator and maybe get down into your basement area. Do they wander, and they wander in and out of other residents' rooms, and they tend to pick things up and put them in their mouth? Or, you know, no matter what, they just, whatever they find, they take and they'll put in their mouth, so that resident could be at great risk as they're wandering, and they're going to need a lot of attention. E1000B, we are looking at the wandering does not intrude on the privacy or activity of others. So let's look at it. How does it impact everyone else? And then, or yes, the wandering intrudes on the privacy or activities of others, whether or not the other residents complain or communicate displeasure or annoyance. So here we have to say, even though the residents may not complain, let's say Sally wanders and she's constantly in and out of other residents' rooms, even though the other residents are really gracious and nice and don't complain, we still need to make the determination, if they're going in and out of other people's rooms, that that may impact on the privacy of our other residents. So let's talk through a couple of scenarios here. So a resident wanders away from the nursing home in his pajamas at 3 a.m. Well, first and foremost, that's your worst nightmare, right? Yeah, I have to tell you, as a director of nursing, yeah, absolutely. All right, so our resident wanders away at 3 a.m. in his pajamas. When staff members talk to him, he insists he was looking for his wife. This elopement behavior has occurred when he was living at home. And on one occasion, he became lost and was missing for 3 days, leading his family to choose nursing home admission for his personal safety. So let's just talk for a second about this scenario. What do you think about this? What did you know? What should you have known about this resident? Guess what? He's at risk for elopement at home. Can you imagine having to make this phone call to this family? What did they do? Why did they put this resident in the nursing home? Because he's at risk, right? Can you imagine? How did this, first off, I'd want to say, how did this happen? How did this happen? How did this resident get out of this nursing home? When you knew he has gone missing in the past. So this would be a not so happy report to the Department of Public Health. This is when you say, oh my God, I'm grayer already before you even get to the facility to do the investigation on this one. All right, so really, I wanted to bring forward a couple of things because although this is a good example, there's so much information here that says, guess what? You had clear warning that this person was at risk for elopement, and you have an obligation in the organization to make sure, if you're going to admit that resident, you better make sure that you have systems and processes in place that can help keep that resident safe. But anyway, he wandered away, and he was trying to find his wife. That's the main part of this scenario. So wandering that results in elopement from the nursing home places the resident at significant risk of getting into dangerous situations. We all agree on that, right? Once he's out of your doors, definitely he could fall, he could get into traffic, it could be cold. This is how people wander away from the nursing home and die. And it happens every year. So it is a real issue. All right, so let's look at another scenario here. So a resident wanders, well, actually, let me go back to this other scenario, not literally go back to it, but what other information that would inform you for Section E here? He said he was going to look for his wife. So what else would you code here? He had a fixed delusion. So you want to make sure in this scenario you'd also capture the delusion. All right, he was going to find his wife. So make sure these inform each other. All right, so E1000 wandering. So a resident wanders away from the nursing home at 7 a.m. Hopefully it's not the same nursing home. Always they got a problem. So staff find him crossing a busy street against the light. Oh, my Lord. When staff try to persuade him to return, he becomes angry and says, my boss called and I have to get to the office. When staff remind him that he has been retired many years, he continues to insist that he must get to work. So how would you code E1000A? right, yes. Resident wandering is associated with elopement from the nursing home and into a dangerous traffic situation. Code is placing the resident at significant risk for getting into a place of potential danger. In addition, here's another situation where we have a fixed illusion, right? So we want to make sure that we would code that one. All right. How would 1000B be coded? The correct coding for E1000B is no. Based on this information, there is no indication that the resident intruded on the privacy or activity of others. So the first one says, did it place them at risk? And the second was, did it intrude on others' privacy? So here, because he wandered out, it didn't really get into anyone else's privacy. All right, so a resident propels himself in his wheelchair into a room of another resident, blocking the door to the other resident's bathroom. So how would we code E1000A? Now, so E1000A is what? Whether we put him at risk. Okay, so E1000A is no. Based on this information, there is no indication that the resident wandering placed him at significant risk. Could this be answered yes? Yes. Absolutely. If it was that same guy who liked to hit people with a cane when they came in his room, right? So depending, have you ever found that resident who tended to wander to one resident's room, right? And if the other resident was just really sweet about it and like it didn't bother them, it was that person who always screamed, "Get him out!" you know, and threatened him and got so agitated and had the cane or walker or whatever, it could be a major issue. It definitely could be. So the significance, guess what, is up to your clinical judgment. Right. You get to make that decision. All right? All right. So how would B be coded? Yes. Moving about in this manner with the use of a wheelchair meets the definition of wandering, and then the resident has intruded into other residents' rooms so that he was definitely there intruding on others' privacy. So E1100, change in behavior, other symptoms. So here what we're looking at is change in behavior may be an important indicator of a health status change. Again, that whole idea of potential for delirium. And it may be because of an environmental stimuli. And it may be positive, they may have a positive response to treatment, or it may be an adverse effect from a treatment. So if we've changed a medication or something, it may be that this may be what we're seeing as an outcome from that. So we're going to review the response provided in items E100 to 1000 on the current MDS assessment. So this is kind of that summary question, kind of wrapping it up, and you've seen that as a theme through a lot of our sections. We're going to compare responses provided on the prior MDS. So it's going to be important for you to have the previous MDS to say how did they do. And we're going to make a global assessment of the change of behaviors from the most recent to the current MDS. This is going to be a little bit of a difficult situation because there's a lot of items that we're looking at between E100 and E1000. And how do we decide? They may have improved in some and declined in others. So this is, again, a clinical judgment scenario. You guys get to get a sense about how much time and effort needed to go in to manage this resident's behavior, the intensity of the behaviors, maybe the effect upon the resident, the effect upon others, and you pull it all together, you say, this is the way they were, let's say, 90 days ago, and this is how they are today, and I have to decide, are they the same, better, or worse? I need to make a clinical judgment here. For residents with multiple behavior symptoms, it's possible that different behaviors will vary in different directions. I kind of talked about that. One behavior may improve while others worsen. And using our clinical judgment to rate the overall direction of the behaviors. Are we heading in the right direction? Do we feel like we're getting a better handle on it? And it seems like things are going better? All right, great. If not, if we feel like things are getting worse, we're finding that we need a lot more staff attention, it's more frustrating, then we may have had a decline. And we need to estimate the net effect of the behaviors. So when we code this item, this 1100, we are really looking at a couple of things. Are they zero? Are they the same? Are they basically, you know what, they're really not changed. Yeah, they might have improved in some and declined in the other. But when we all really look at it, the resident's basically the same for us. No more effort to take care of them. Do we say, oh, you know what, we put some systems and processing in place, they've really settled down, they seem like they're doing better. So we're going to say they improved. Or, you know, no, we're heading in the wrong direction. They definitely are worse. Their behaviors are escalating. Or that it's non-applicable. There was no prior MDS assessment for the resident. So if they don't have a previous MDS, this item is going to be coded as a 3. All right? So here we have a scenario. So on the prior assessment, the resident was reported to wander on 4 out of 5 days. Because of elopement, the behavior placed the resident at significant risk for getting to a dangerous place. And on the current assessment, the resident was found to wander on 2 of the last 5 days. Because a door alarm system is now in use, the resident is not at risk for elopement and getting to dangerous places. So we put an environmental process in place that then decreased the chance of that resident getting into danger. However, the resident is now wandering into the rooms of other residents and intruding on their privacy. This requires occasional redirection by the staff. So we have to make a determination. So although one component of the resident's wandering behavior is worse, as it has begun to intrude on the privacy of others, it is less frequent and less dangerous without a recent elopement, and is therefore improved over overall since the last assessment. So again, this is a clinical judgment that you get to make. You say, listen, that door alarm was the best thing since sliced bread. Because we were so constantly vigilant, every time you ever got near the door, a staff member was going and, you know, redirecting the resident. It just took so much energy. Well, now we have the alarm. He doesn't, you know, he can go to the door, but he's not going to be able to get through the door. And now he seems to be going into residents' rooms, but it's really not that intrusive. And based off of our resources and what we've had to apply to take care of this resident, he's really improved overall. It's taking less resources. All right, so let's look at a practice scenario. At the time of the last assessment, the resident was ambulatory and would threaten and hit other residents daily. He recently suffered a hip fracture and is not ambulatory. He is not approaching, threatening, or assaulting other residents. Well, he can't because he's not as mobile right now with his hip fracture. However, the resident is now combative when staff try to assist with dressing, bathing, and is hitting staff members daily. So now, so this was someone who is going out and threatening other residents. He can't do that anymore, but now he's threatening staff. How would you code this person? And again, this is just general. You don't have all the information. How would you code this person? The same. They basically determined, well, he was doing it to others, now he's doing it to the staff, but it's about the same level of aggression. All right. So for this person, they determined that he was about the same. So here we have another scenario. So on the prior assessment, the resident with Alzheimer's disease was reported to be wandering 2 out of 7 days and has responded well to redirection. On the most recent assessment, he has noted that the resident has been wandering more frequently, and now 5 to 7 days, and has attempted to elope from the building on 2 occasions. This behavior places the resident at significant risk for personal harm. The resident has been placed on more frequent location checks and requires additional redirection from staff. He is also provided with an elopement bracelet so that the staff has been alerted when he attempts to leave the facility. And the intensity required of staff surveillance because of the dangerousness and the frequency of the wandering behavior has significantly increased. So this is a person who now all of a sudden is really constantly exit seeking. So how would you code this person? Worse, I think it's pretty, okay. Because it's very clear in how they wrote this example. He is taking a lot more resources. He has definitely increased and ramped up on his exit-seeking behavior, and so we would say that his behavior is worse. Okay, so basically, when we're doing this, there's, like I said, a couple of key indicators that we have to do here. It's really, I think, your biggest challenge when you go back to your facilities and you train on this is going to be your documentation piece and having staff consistently put things in the record, especially for those whose these behaviors have become commonplace, and educating your staff that it's not the intent behind the behavior, but we need to document the behavior. The other hard thing to teach your staff is this whole idea of clinical judgment. So what you're going to find is that people want, especially MDS people, they tend to want things to be black and white. And they really struggle with this whole clinical judgment thing. I think it tends to be, if you talk to your unit managers or some of your good floor staff, if you ask them the clinical judgment in their opinion, is the person better or worse or the same, they have no trouble in giving you a clinical judgment on it. They can really, you know, say, listen, I've talked to all the staff across all the shifts. They're really about the same, or they're worse at night, they're better during the day, whatever it is. So they have no trouble in giving you kind of their opinion on whether the person is better or worse. So there are some challenges, but I think I'm really happy that this tool is allowing us as professionals to make a clinical judgment, because I cannot teach or put in a manual what you see, hear, feel, and know, being in the environment. And so we must empower people to use those skills, use your critical thinking, take this information in. The other thing that my parting kind of statement, and then we're going to be ending early, I think, for my time, but is that if you truly use this tool, there's so much information that's been given on so many levels. You have to really pull it all together. It's really going to take an interdisciplinary approach in communicating to each other the different items and issues that you found. Because here we're looking at behaviors, and what did we figure out? There was an incontinence issue that would push us back to section H, right? Maybe it wasn't informed as well in section H, but we're figuring it out in section E. But no matter what, we need to deal with the issue. The person has a new onset of incontinence. So we can't work in silos. We can't work independently. We all have to work together. And I think when we look at this from the quality perspective, using critical thinking skills, what we're going to end up with is what we all wanted, right? A more relevant tool with better, which forces us to use critical thinking skills to take this information, pull it all together, forces us to communicate and work together for the ultimate betterment of our residents and for better outcomes.